Morgan Freeman is best known for his captivating performances on the big screen, from his Oscar-winning role as Eddie Dupree in Million Dollar Baby and Nelson Mandela in Invictus, to God in Bruce Almighty, and of course Red in The Shawshank Redemption.
Sometimes it makes me sad, though, Andy being gone. I have to remind myself that some birds aren't meant to be caged. Their feathers are just too bright.
We need inspiration, Francois. Because in order to build our nation, we must all exceed our own expectations.
A teenager who says no to drugs and yes to an education, that's a miracle. People want me to do everything for them. What they don't realize is they have the power. You want to see a miracle, son? Be the miracle.
People die every day, Frankie. Mopping floors, washing dishes. And you know what their last thought is? I never got my shot. Because of you, Maggie got her shot. If she dies today, you know what her last thought will be? I think I did all right.
Get busy living, or get busy dying. That's goddamn right.
Morgan Freeman there in some of his great cinematic roles. But Morgan is not just a renowned actor and filmmaker. He is also a passionate advocate for blues music. In fact, he has a deep connection with the genre and opened a blues club, so-called Ground Zero, in Clarksdale, Mississippi, due to its proximity to the crossroads where blues legend Robert Johnson supposedly sold his soul to the devil. Morgan will join the RTE Concert Orchestra later this week as Master of Ceremonies in the Delta Blues Project, a concert which puts some of the greatest blues music ever performed into an orchestral setting. I'm delighted to be joined on Arena this evening by Morgan Freeman and the co-owner of the Ground Zero Blues Club, Eric Meyer. Morgan, you were born in the Deep South, and you can trace your family's history back to that area, to the area, in fact, where blues music itself was born.
Actually, my family history is rooted primarily in Mississippi. You know, the two arms of my family are both rooted in Mississippi. One's black, the other one is white-based. My mother's side of the family are mulatto, as my great-great-grandfather was white and married my great-great-grandmother, who was black, in Mississippi. These things did happen in the 1800s. Voila.
The fact that you have that white and black ancestry, how unusual was that at that time in Mississippi?
It's very usual. If you look at black people and they're not black, they're mixed for the most part. That's how you can tell primarily, particularly West Africans, from American blacks. That we're like all most Americans, we're mongrels.
Let's go back to the 1937 and the Mississippi area that you were born into. What sort of society was that?
Well, I can't really tell you, Sean. In 1937, Mississippi, of course, we were highly segregated. As a child, I didn't have anything to do with it. I was not affected by it in any meaningful way. And left Mississippi when I was 6.5 years old, was gone for about 7 months, then came back. I spent most of my formative years in Mississippi. It was a segregated society, but I had a good childhood, really good childhood. Great teachers, parenting, all that was all any kid would need to grow up.
Although you didn't meet your mother properly until you were 7.5, 8 years old.
Six and a half, right. I knew her the minute I saw her, but Yeah, I was raised up until then by my paternal grandmother.
What part did music play in that early life? Were you aware of the blues music of the area, of the region?
I remember, I suppose, I don't know what you would call them, but if you had a drink of moonshine and they had a guitar, they would play music. And of course, it was almost always blues. There was nothing else to play. I didn't get into it properly until I was somewhere near my teens, you know, up around 12, 13 years old, when I came back to Mississippi to live full time. I had been in Chicago with my mom for, oh, I don't know, 2-3 years, something like that. Mm.
You knew, I think, even at that stage, that somehow when you were acting, you were at home in some kind of way. What did that acting kind of home, what did that feel like?
Well, I don't know. You know, when you find your niche in life, there was a kind of power that you feel, that you experience. This is where I'm very comfortable and have no qualms about what I'm doing here. I know what I'm doing. And that is always my life.
The music that you heard then, you said that it was really in your teens that you started to come close to it. Did that have any sense of I'm home, or was it, you know, was there some kind of belonging feeling within that music?
No. I within music, yes, but my musical tastes were rather eclectic. The only music that I've ever heard that I couldn't quite get into was opera. But everything that stems from the blues, anything, rock and roll, pop music, jazz, all have some connection to Delta blues, believe it or not.
I suppose specifically they all have a connection, many people would say, to Robert Johnson, who, let's face it, in terms of where you grew up, he's a local boy.
Yeah, he's a local boy. He was right around where I grew up, Greenwood, that area.
And the famous crossroads where he supposedly sold his soul to the devil, is that quite close by?
That was in Clarksdale. Clarksdale was like an hour's drive from Greenwood.
In fact, Sean, it's behind our club. It's virtually in the parking lot.
Behind your own, this is Eric Meyer now talking to us. It's behind that parking lot, that crossroads.
Yeah, so Ground Zero Blues Club. You know, the story has it, and with some proof, that it's literally in our parking lot. So when Morgan and Bill Luckett co-founded the club, I think it was just incredibly visionary to put it right there.
I don't have to ask you then, Morgan, have you ever been to that crossroads if it's right outside your club? But I wonder what you feel about this idea that, you know, in fact, Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil so that he could play this great blues music. That's how the story goes. Do you buy that at all? Or is it, you know, just some sort of story around?
That's pure myth. For one thing, I'm not one who believes in the devil, for one thing. Selling your soul to the devil to play. You know, blues is actually called the devil's music by the clergy. It isn't. The blues is merely lament. You know, everybody's singing the blues. They're singing about how sad they are that their woman left, or they're on the streets, don't have money, don't have a job. That it's all personal lament for the most part. B.B. King, really gone. I'll be back on my feet someday. You know?
What you've just done, Morgan, suggests to me that you should be singing as part of this concert that you're involved in. Will we hear that wonderful speaking voice of yours that we all know? Will we hear it in singing mode?
I don't. Probably not, really. I like to sing, but I cannot claim a real talent for singing.
If you're not going to sing yourself, then who are the touchstone? Who were the touchstone singers, Morgan? Who became those important blues singers for you? You've mentioned B.B. King there. I think that's important. Of course, 1987, U2 made a phenomenal version of When Love Comes to Town with B.B. King.
B.B. had a shortcoming, however, as a singer. He couldn't play the guitar and sing at the same time. He was a good guitar player, but he had to either play the guitar or sing. Couldn't do both.
Going back to Robert Johnson, he could play the guitar and he could sing at the same time. How subversive an act was it? You know, think about the society he was in. And I've heard the suggestion that, in fact, you know, when they say, "My baby done me wrong," or, you know, "Don't want my baby to come back to me anymore," that's often about, in fact, the plantation owner or the boss. They couldn't say "he" because they'd be in big trouble. How subversive an act was it, even singing a blues song in Robert Johnson's time?
Well, if the master heard it and understood it, it's very subversive. Otherwise, no, it's just slack language, you know. I'll bet you know that the separation between the Irish and the English, the Irish had a conversational code that they could use. Same thing in the South.
Yeah, well, we had our own language that we could use that quite simply the English couldn't understand, but colonization meant we lost that language. Interestingly enough that you mention Irish, because if you'd read the Stephen King novella before you did Shawshank Redemption, you'd have been looking for an Irishman to play that part of Red. So you took that from us, Morgan.
Yes, indeedy. I didn't read the book because the first page of the book, it's described Red as Irish. I said, well, no, this is not going to, I'm not going to be able to do this. So I didn't bother with the book. I just stuck to the script.
There's not a day goes by I don't feel regret. Not because I'm in here, because you think I should. I look back on the way I was then. A young, stupid kid who committed that terrible crime. I want to talk to him. I want to try to talk some sense to him. Tell him the way things are. But I can't. That kid's long gone, and this old man is all that's left. I gotta live with that. Rehabilitated? It's just a bullshit word. So you go on and stamp your form, Sonny, and stop wasting my time. Because to tell you the truth, I don't give a shit.
I suppose that is ultimately what an actor has to do with a part. It doesn't matter about anything else. It is the script that's the thing. Is that always the starting, middle and ending point for you?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. All my life. I got on the stage first time when I was like 8 years old. And, you know, it's like going back to the womb, right where I belong.
At the age of eight?
At the age of eight. Yeah. When I was 12 years old, we had these little contests. What's the word I'm looking for?
Talent contest or something? Was it a talent contest, something like that?
Talent contest of all kinds, yeah. But you would have music. We had bands going against each other. We'd organize drama things that we did. And when I was 12 years old, I won my first Best Actor award at age 12 in Mississippi.
Wow.
So, you know, and of course, everybody in school, I'm somebody.
And that award, in terms of the subsequent awards, including an Oscar, where does that award sit?
It's up there with the Oscar. I have this cabinet, as always.
Yeah. When you won that award at the age of 12, was there any comment on your voice? Now, it may not have dropped to the basso profondo that it is today, but was it?
No. I didn't start getting comments on my voice until after the electric company. But when I was in school, I went to college for about 20 minutes. Figuratively speaking. And I was in the theater department, and I studied voice development and voice and diction. And I had a really terrific professor who knew exactly how to put a voice on a person. And that's where my voice began to be my voice.
And the Electric Company, of course, a famous children's television program in America in and around, I suppose, the 60s and 70s, was around about that time that it was on the television, maybe even earlier?
Yeah, 70s to mid-70s.
Yeah. And you say that this teacher kind of found your voice. What about the accent? Were you speaking with a very deep Southern accent at that time? Was that molded out of you?
I had a deep Southern accent, and that got modified by him, because voice and diction is very important. That means no slurring, no eliding, hitting your final consonants as you speak, you know, stuff like that. So I got an actor's voice, which is not supposed to be regional.
Did that annoy you at the time? Does it annoy you in any way now?
No, not at all.
And in terms of when it comes to doing an accent then for a role that you might be playing, is that again part of the actor's tools and you just have to accept it and run with it and make it happen?
I'm not really that talented. I know actors who can just do voices or accents. It just make it easy. I can't do it. I'd have to listen to it over and over and over and over. I did manage to come close to Nelson Mandela in the film Victus, but that was serious study that got me there.
And I guess that's a different type of role from there is such a thing as a normal role, but from a role where you're playing a fictional character, you don't have something that you have to emulate in some way. How important was it for you to get something close to the reality of Nelson Mandela's sound, Nelson Mandela's look, Nelson Mandela's walk, etc.?
Extremely. Extremely important to get as close to him as possible. What happened with Mandela was when he published A Long Walk to Freedom, he was asked by somebody in the press, and if your book becomes a movie, who would you like to play you? And he named me to do it. So the producer at the time, who had the property, his name was Anant Singh, put us together. I happened to be in South Africa, and I got to meet Mandela at his home in Joburg. And I said, if this comes to be and I get to play you, I'm going to have to know you. So every time we were in proximity for years after that, we got together and I would hold his hand. That's just energy transference for me, the actor. If you're going to play someone, some real person, somebody you can get close to, it's best to touch them. It's energy transference. I think that works very well.
Our enemy is no longer the Afrikaner. They are our fellow South Africans, our partners in a democracy. And they treasure Springbok rugby. If we take that away, we lose them. I know. all of the things they denied us. But this is no time to celebrate petty revenge. This is the time to build our nation. You elected me your leader. Let me lead you now.
I'm wondering about energy transference between a director and an actor. You've spoken many times about Clint Eastwood and obviously the best supporting actor, that Oscar nomination to match your pin from the 12-year-old acting for the 12-year-old actor, Million Dollar Baby with Clint Eastwood, and later, of course, or earlier, Unforgiven, The Unforgiven, that version of the Western that Clint Eastwood gives us. How does the energy transference work between you and him, any director, actor? Is it different?
Clint, I think he's an actor's director. I say that to mean that he doesn't direct actors. He directs movies. He hires actors, and it's your job. And I love that about him, that, you know, you establish your own character, you play it, and you do what the scene calls for, and I'll have the scene set up. Cameras will be where I want them to be. The lights will be where we want them to be. And go for it. He never says action, and he never says cut. He's his own person on the movie set. Wonderful. And I think I was probably, I begged him to direct Invictus, but it's one of the few movies he directed he wasn't in.
And again, vital to have him there, I would say. Did he support the way you approached that Mandela character very much? As you said, that energy transference of holding Mandela's hand and the like?
He loved it. He loved it.
You strike me, even as you describe it, and I know Clint Eastwood is one of these two or three takes, and that's it. If you haven't got it then, forget about it. It's not going to happen. Do you think that comes to a large extent? Your first big break in the movies, I suppose, was in your, I think you were 50 at the time. I know there had been an earlier movie, but all of your work, very highly lauded on stage. You know, you don't get takes on stage. It's go out and do it. There is no retake.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the way he operates is strictly on hiring, you know? Hire the actor you want and then let him fly. He's really good at that. And he may be my favorite of all film directors.
I guess for the concert, the upcoming concert then, is it a case of hire the musicians you want? Give them the music and let them fly. Is that part of what you'll be hoping will happen at this upcoming concert on Sunday next?
Well, yeah, I've never been to a rehearsal for a concert for an orchestra, you know, but I have watched some of the big ones direct. It's about the music, you know. I think probably you have to audition to get into a symphony orchestra. I'm not sure about that, but I would think you would have to audition. After that, yeah. I think they just let you interpret the music, but you have to be within really very short little parameters, because if you stand out and you're in the string section, wait a minute. I don't want to hear you. If you want a solo, we can work something out, but.
You want to hear the horns and you want to hear the saxophone, you want to hear those woodwinds. Is that what you're looking for in terms of blues interpretation?
Yeah, not in terms of blues interpretation. Blues interpretation, primarily, bluesmen are guitarists. Because you can't blow a saxophone and then sing. It's harder to do, you know. I don't know if anybody even plays the fiddle and sings.
There are a few, but they're rare.
Yeah, you know, so.
And Eric, you might explain to us how the blues music, the guitar music and the voice, how will that transfer into an orchestral style of music? How will that work?
This is highly unique to take a blues, you know, Delta blues songs and then infuse it with kind of the orchestral sound. So we're excited. This is going to bridge really two generations, two styles of music. And frankly, you keep in mind, these blues artists don't really have set lists. They play instinctively. And so this is a very unique combination that I guarantee is going to just really dazzle the audience.
So we will have plenty of guitars, plenty of songs. Morgan, thank you so much for being with us this evening, yourself and Eric. We listened to some blues music to finish up, and looking forward to seeing you in Ireland on this coming Sunday, both yourself and Eric. Thanks so much for being with us, Morgan.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean.
Eric Meyer and Morgan Freeman there. What a joy and privilege it was to speak with both of them. Morgan Freeman will join the RTÉ Concert Orchestra. Continued celebrations of the orchestra's 75th anniversary. The Delta Blues Project is the title of Sunday's concert, June the 11th at the O'Reilly Hall in University College Dublin. You can find out full details on orchestras.rte.ie. Promised a little bit of blues to finish up with. What better than Muddy Waters?
One, two, three. I'm a thing to you, above and round. I'm a thing to you, above and round.
I'm a King Bee, that from Muddy Waters, but the King Bee that we were speaking to before that, Morgan Freeman, of course. And just to remind you, the RTÉ Concert Orchestra, the Delta Blues Project, Sunday, June the 11th at the O'Reilly Hall in University College Dublin. Morgan Freeman will be the MC for that event. Details on orchestras.rte.ie.